Hi everyone, I'm Lauren Petrovic and you're listening to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. This show is all about celebrating the most extraordinary leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders, and CEOs shaping the world of luxury today. Today's a very special episode of the podcast as we're coming to you live from Brooklyn, New York, with a remarkable group of ethical gem suppliers to discuss the state of the gemstone industry. Our focus turns to a clever group of entrepreneurs who are revolutionizing the gemstone industry by fostering transparent supply chains, empowering artisanal mining, and cutting communities worldwide. Their mission goes beyond the mere trade of exquisite gemstones. It encompasses the vital role of educating industry professionals and consumers on the significance of responsible sourcing practices. Drawing from my own entrepreneurial journey in the sustainable fine jewelry space, I know from experience the profound impact and meaningful connections that arise from collaborating with conscious and responsible suppliers and sourcing ethical gemstones. In this episode, we'll dive into the essence of sustainability within the gemstone trade, exploring its global implications and societal significance. We also discuss how technology, while a powerful tool, is only as effective as the intent behind its use. As we explore the rich culture of gem varieties originating across regions such as Australia, Brazil, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and beyond, one thing becomes abundantly clear: the deep-rooted foundation of trust within this community. While trust remains the linchpin upholding industry standards in a somewhat fragmented gemstone sector, we discuss the necessity for innovative solutions that bolster this trust with enhanced transparency and accountability mechanisms. I am very excited to share this one with you. Please enjoy this very thoughtful and insightful discussion. We are live recording a special episode for the Responsible Luxury Podcast. And today I am pleased to be joined by Ian and Brian. And to give a brief introduction to the special speakers today, Brian from Nature's Geometry. It's a family-run business since 1989, now three generations strong, encompassing everything from mining, sourcing, cutting, and creating jewels. They are producing in Brazil, where they introduced formalizing rutilated and smoky quartz mine region in Bahia and helped establish the miners' cooperative there. Brian is a passionate geologist and lapidary artist, as well as designer and expert in Brazilian gems, specifically in Pariba and colored stones. Quindi grew up in the gem business and created the core studio space in LA to showcase Nature's Geometry's gems and luxury jewels as a place to collaborate with and source for other designers and artists interested in working with more responsible stones. Right next to me is Ian Bone, the co-founder of Capricorn Gems, a wholesale gem business that specializes in sapphire, boulder, opal, zircon, and chrysoprase from central Queensland, Australia. Together with his co-founder, Rodney Beatty, they bring top-quality traceable gemstones to designers and makers worldwide. So, Ian, to kick us off in discussion today, I think it would be a good opportunity to lay the groundwork and give us a brief introduction to the ethical gem suppliers started by you as one of the founding members in 2017.
So the ethical gem suppliers group really got started in the UK. It was actually Stuart and myself that got the whole notion of an event, a fair, an activity to bring traceable gemstones to a market through a show or fair type arrangement. As we all know, traditionally, gemstone selling has been quite an open situation where basically groups of gemstone vendors get together, sell their product, and there really has been no differentiation between where those vendors source their product. So it was basically a for want of a better word, a free-for-all in terms of the selling of gemstones. That's the first point. But the second point, probably more importantly for us, was is the style and the way we sold gemstones. And we recognized and saw it was very important to have an underlying, I guess, relationship with the people we were selling our stones to.
Right.
It wasn't good enough for us just to go and lay out on the table a whole range of stones, sell the stones, walk away and forget about it. That wasn't what we were on about. I can remember Stuart and I going to a conference in Edinburgh back in 2017, and it was a conference of designer makers. And I can clearly recall part of the conversation was then the difficulty that designer makers had in sourcing ethically traceable provenance-based gemstones. It was clearly a problem. And the discussion on the floor at that point of time was how can we source products that we know where they come from, essentially, and that we could be sure that we're mined and we're sourced and we're obtained in a responsible way.
Right.
So that's sort of got us thinking about, well, we do have product. We do have an ability to do that. And we do have an ability to bring those materials to the market. So while we were doing that, of course, Columbia over here had been doing it for many years as an individual business and within their structure. Some people have been doing odds and sods around the place with ethical sourcing, but no one really, and I don't think, people can correct me if I'm wrong, had actually got a bit of structure behind it to create an event type
collective
market, if you like, in a sense of what we did and what we've subsequently done here in the US. So really that was the genesis of how it began, and the processes then of bringing it to the US accelerating with other people coming in who all also had the same ideas, the same notions, the same thoughts, the same concepts and ideas about ethical sourcing. And hence that's what we've got today.
That's amazing. And a couple of 5 years later, we're still...
Well, indeed. And we're in our fifth year at Tucson coming up next year. And, you know, it's established as a group. And I think we've got a fabulous clientele that come and visit us now. And not just, I might say, not just for the gemstones, but also for the experience. The experience of being able to walk into the room and not feel that you're pressured for a start to have to buy something.
Right.
But you feel comfortable that you might even learn something when you're there. But you can associate with us as a group of people that really, you know, are more than happy to impart our information, impart our education, impart our story to help the designer maker better their business.
And sharing that knowledge, because everyone in this room is really focused on education and educating their customers, these designers and makers, to be able to educate their consumers.
Absolutely.
On the products and where everything is sourced.
Because what we're doing here today, yesterday, the day before, is selling product, but we're also telling the story about the product. We're also informing people about where it came from, who mined it, how it was mined, the journey to the mine, the cutting, et cetera, so that when they go back to their studios with the pieces that they buy and mount them and create beautiful jewelry, put that in the market, then they can actually feel confident that they're fully informed about the gemstone that they've purchased, that they have in their jewelry piece.
Right, right. Brian, I wanted to ask you more about your journey into the colored gemstone industry, and primarily where Nature Geometry operates. So to get us started, can you tell us more about your work in Brazil?
Welcome to this talk. I'm speaking to you from the Great Sonoran Desert, Tucson. Our business is connected with actual production. We're involved in mining, cutting in Brazil. We've been in Brazil for over three decades working. And Brazil is a special location for us because my wife is from Brazil and we have family there. But being involved in the mining, I had the opportunity of being the first person to stake claims in this very remote part of Brazil where we mine rutilated quartz. By doing that, getting that process of formalizing it, some claims, I was able to help the other local landowners go through the same process, even though it took 12 years in that initial process. Once it happened, we were able to bring on board a lot of other landowners. And the formalization process is an incentive that is globally part of the process of our industry becoming more transparent and, quote, ethical. Because by helping these communities become legalized, it gives them the opportunity to begin to market their stones through the supply chain. And people like us and Ian and Columbia Gem House, et cetera, if we are willing to help these folks on the ground and bring their story, which includes not only the stone and the legal processes, but for me, very important is the culture and the environment, the nature of the land and the people becomes essentially a big part of any story connected to any stone. Because the stones we work with, metals that we work with, are all precious elements from Earth. And we have the privilege of working with these elements and then creating art and beauty and passing it on to a consuming public. And what's really special for in our philosophy, nature's geometry, these precious earth elements help connect people to nature in general. And you as artists and makers, you're all getting to handle those elements and pass them on to people. So what we want to do is bring further connection through education about the place, about the science, about the land. It can go on forever, but the more story you have, the more connection to the place and people, it brings more relativity to what your products are, I think.
Both Capricorn Gems and Nature's Geometry are both doing fantastic initiatives working to build more sustainability and more ethical sourcing and continuing on sharing that light and education to your customers. But both businesses may operate slightly different, where first where your source countries are, but then also maybe the supply chain is a little bit different. So Ian, I wanted to shine a light on your supply chain and talk a little bit about your experience working also with your co-founder Rodney and where you guys source, how you guys source, because your main country is in Australia. So tell us a little bit about it, the country and the mining process and bringing those stones to market.
Well, there's no doubt about it that there are varying supply chain measures within this group. You know, we all have and even within singular vendors here, there are a whole range of different supply chain. And Eric spoke a little bit about that yesterday in terms of the ability to discern the supply chain to be whether or not that's going to be suitable for the delivery of the product or not. In our case, the establishment of Capricorn Gems was driven by the fact that we had a geographical area that contained four gemstones, and those gemstones just were fortuitous for us to be able to bring to the market because we knew where they were from. We live in the area. We've been in the business for many years, particularly Rod has been in the business for many years to know the full story of where they were mined, who mined them, and the bringing of them to the market. So the creation of our business was somewhat slightly different than probably many others because ours, again, only 8 years old, was built on a known geographical area of gemstones that the market had a desirability for. So having said that, we knew that the whole story of provenance and traceability was fairly clear. Underpinning that was that we're operating in a first world country, using some relativities here, compared to much of the colored gemstone mining industry, which operates in third world countries, for want of a better way of expressing the variations. There is no point of view in terms of other than using that terminology just that for that purpose, a la South America, African countries, etc. So in our case, we already have established rule of law. We already, it's like the US here, you know, there's already a process, there's already a mining rules and regulations processes established that have been established for hundreds of years, basically. So you just can't go out and dig a hole. You just can't go out and anyone mine. You just can't. There are certain things. You have to have workplace health and safety. You have to have labor laws. You have to have PPE, personal protective equipment, when you mine. You just can't go and run your own show, a little bit like what might happen in other third world countries. So we're not facing the same circumstances.
Yeah.
Right? So we're operating from a different level from the get-go. Yeah. So with that in mind, and coupled with the geographical understanding of the product, it was a different mechanism for us to bring our product to the market, if you know what I mean. It wasn't the same as many of my colleagues around the room face in bringing their product to the market merely because of the location of the sourcing of the product.
It's different problem sets, like we spoke about before, dealing with one geography, but also the countries in place, some frameworks are more established in Australia versus other countries. So it's a slightly different approach bringing products to market.
Yes. I mean, I think the concept of artisanal mining and traceability back to the mine is still there, but we don't face the issues, problems in terms of all of those features I just mentioned,
right,
because they're already established. And we have to have those measures in place before mining is undertaken. Extraction.
Fascinating. So turning it over to Brian, I want to dig deeper into some potential challenges or your experience with mining in Brazil and working directly with some of the miners and in the artisanal community where you work.
Well, as Ian said, quote, first world countries have laws and regulations, and it's very easy. Much of the rest of the world and most of artisanal mining in colored gemstones specifically, the conditions are very different. The opportunities are less. So I think the opportunity as an industry, our industry, is to lend more support to communities, bring more benefits to the communities, equity in worth and pay. And those are things that as an industry, we are beginning to work on more and more. I mean, we see it through projects in Africa. We have projects that we're going to be initiating in Brazil. A simple example is we're getting funding through nonprofit organization to purchase dust mass protection, because we have miners that are currently dying from working decades underground without proper protection. A, they didn't understand, they didn't even know what was happening. And B, they can't afford the equipment. So by raising funds and bringing it directly to the people and connecting it with education about what is silicosis, how is this happening? That's a very small thing that we can contribute. And that's what we're doing in Brazil, where we're mining the rutilated quartz. So our industry is actually coming together more and more through group efforts, organizations, raising funds, and creating projects. And what we really can do as an industry is invest in projects that help communities at the source. And I think we'll be seeing more of that in the future. It adds relevance to our product. You know, it's like, who needs jewelry? But if our industry can demonstrate the benefits that we can bring to communities and people, millions of people around the world, to better their lives and also invest in protecting the land and improving land, those, in my opinion, this is what we can be doing as an industry. And I'm happy to say that we're seeing more and more efforts and concentration in it. And people that come to our events, for example, you're already on that sort of philosophy. And it's not just jewelry industry, it's fashion. It's all the industries that have to do with luxury sort of have a responsibility to find solutions and ways to improve equity, help, you know, improve opportunity for women. That's one of the main things that we can do. Bring more benefit to those communities and invest in preserving land or protecting land. I mean, I'm trying to say a lot in a few words, but I think you get the picture that our industry, the jewelry industry, is very special in that we're a global community. The industry, or the act of making jewelry and appreciating gems and metals, goes back thousands of years. So it's a very culturally rich global community and family. And I think we have the opportunity and the responsibility to create actions that we can demonstrate and bring those stories to you and to the end consumer.
That's a perfect segue into switch gears a bit. Ian, before this, we were talking about the growing consciousness of this next generation of consumers and also entering the business. And Brian also touched upon, we're a part of this growing movement, yet there's still the designers, the makers, the ethical, you guys as ethical suppliers are still in the shadows of the industry when it comes to the global consumer in the market. So I wanted to switch gears a bit and talk more into the future of where this slow but growing movement is heading and where you see the consumer mindset starting to shift and where you see us going in the next couple of years.
Look, that's an interesting question and a debate in its own right. And I think, you know, we are really at the forefront of that debate merely because we're here in this room and that we've made a commitment to do what we do. The question and the challenges we face in that circumstance, I think, are very important to consider going forward, and whether or not we collectively and or individually have a role to play in it, which I believe we do. And we continue to do that in our own businesses, but collectively perhaps there's a little bit more activity that we could consider to actually help facilitate, if you like, a movement. But you are right. I mean, in many ways, it's a generational shift. In many ways, it's an emerging generational population shift whereby, can I say, you know, the younger population have much more of an affinity and an understanding of the requirements and the need to be more open and to demand and or expect more openness within our sourcing of product, our consumables. Brian's point, whether it be jewelry, in our case, gems, jewelry, foodstuffs, wood, coffees, bananas, everything that we consume as human beings, the knowledge of where those products came from, I think, is much more evident today than what it's ever has been. What we've seen, I believe, in the jewelry industry, though, is a very slow incremental process. It's not, for us, probably it appears to be too slow. But in some cases, perhaps there are ways that we can sort of, us as a group and designer makers generally, can facilitate that process a little bit more to bring to the general public, to the consumer, the notion of an understanding of more of traceability and sourcing for gemstones. And I do believe that we have a role in that space, because if we are, who is? Who is? You know, the other gemstone vendors aren't, or they would be doing it.
Right.
You know, the other designer makers aren't, or they would be doing it. The big design houses aren't, or they would be doing it. They talk about it, but there's a lot of talk goes on in this industry and not much action. You know, a lot of people.
Well, to be fair, there is more than just talk. There is a lot of action beginning, but it's a small amount. But I think we're at the stage where there will be more effort to invest in action, even the large companies. And even within our industry, there's a lot of emphasis on this subject. Our group is unique, as Ian said, because we came together as a small group organically, and we're offering special events, and we're creating events in Tucson and Brooklyn and California and London. But, you know, to be fair, there are other, there's a lot of consciousness moving forward. And that's the hope for me. You know, we have the high couture brands are putting a lot of talk, but also now we're asking them for funding, whether it's the Cartiers or the Louis Vuitton group. I mean, these people are talking about it, but they need us to create the action. And so we're the grassroots, we're the boots on the ground, and we're here to help make that move forward.
There's no question about
definitely.
It. There is no question about what you're saying there, Brian. My point is that we've not seen that happen. It's 2024, not 2000. You know, we're 25 years down the track since all this has been spoken about. We've got a whole new generation of people here now with expectations of a situation of traceability and provenance. It's, as I say, it's very incremental. It's a push forward. Anyway, my point being is, yes, what can we do? What actual activities can we undertake to try to bring out more of an exposure of tracing and source and provenance to the broader market? And I think that we are challenged with bringing some of those ideas further forward and working with designer makers to achieve those outcomes.
Right.
Because we can't do it as a group of vendors ourselves, because it's not our role to go out into the community.
You guys can only light their torch to their
We can help that process, I think. And there are ways and means that we need to be thinking about to actually help that process a little bit more actively, in my opinion, to enable designer makers to actually go out and be able to say with hand on heart, confidence, et cetera, that they are sourcing their goods and materials from vendors that have a clear understanding of traceability, provenance, and ethical sourcing of their gems. Now, it's already started. There are some designer makers that are very open about the traceability and sourcing of where they get their gemstones from. We know that. We've started to see that happen already. So my challenge and my question to the designer maker community is to be more, well, okay, some of your colleagues are actually saying, okay, I source my gems and materials from XYZ. Why not build on that? Why not facilitate that? Why not create some sort of space there? Because it's a win-win situation. It's a win-win for the designer maker to say they are sourcing their product from established, recognized, traceable source. It's another step in the direction of that relationship building with designer makers to actually help them and empower them to feel confident that they can go into their markets and say, we source our product from XYZ vendor and or group of ethical suppliers. But I think we have to help that. And we have to be very clear and sure that we are squeaky clean, so in want of a better word, we're saying this is our market. This is our wholesale market. We're not going to go left, center, or right and then try to retail. We're going to concentrate on our clientele, who are you people, designer makers. And that's it. And we're going to do the best that we can do, and we're going to help you build your businesses and tell the story of the traceability and the sourcing of where you get your gems from. Why wouldn't we? Exactly. And then when people go to your websites and see that and that story, they feel more confident that you know what's going on as designer makers and you have the full story of the traceability of your products that you've purchased from us.
And I wanted to open this question up for both of you and ask about previous initiatives or perhaps future initiatives that both of your businesses are working on to really push forward this change and transformation that's happening and to move this movement forward, hopefully faster.
Ask Brian that, he might have a remark.
Sure. Okay. So we work in a very remote, beautiful biome in the center of the state of Bahia, Northeast Brazil. It's remote, it's clean, it's beautiful. There's local cultures that are still vibrant, not too polluted by internet, even though everybody has their WhatsApp and internet. But in this place, as I said, we're bringing in dust protection, safety equipment as the first stepping stone Next, we're going to create an opportunity for the women miners to bring their low-grade materials to a facility that we're going to create where we can create tumbled stones. Tumbled stones are not traceable, basically. However, we have a market already waiting for traceable tumble stones. So in Bahia, we can tumble rutilated quartz, smoky quartz, aventurine quartz, blue stones, amethyst. We have a lot of stones available right near where we're mining. And so we're going to create tumbled stones with the women's group of a cooperative. And then with that stepping stone, they will be called stepping stones, because the next infusion of money, we set up a lapidary academy where we begin to teach the locals how to cut and process, where we have domestic and international markets. So we're bringing more value to their product, creating entrepreneurship opportunities. And then from there, once we have those things in operation, we will be investing parallel in regenerative agriculture in the local soils, where we will be teaching, educating again, the way to farm, where you're improving soil over time. And we'll be looking for niche products, which could be essential oils, herbs, spice, medicines, because what we want to create is a parallel economic economy that will be there when the mineral resource ends, since mines are not sustainable. But we want to educate about creating other opportunities. And for this model that we're creating, it will be based on regenerative agriculture, which will be applied anywhere in the world to any mining community. And we see that as a model that can be replicated and will benefit the colored stone industry and create the stories that we've been talking about, and create more relevance for our products. So that's just beginning now. And there's ways that, you know, we're raising money and we can even share those opportunities of, you know, how to contribute, et cetera. But that's the model that we're working on. And we're working with a local, state, and federal government in Brazil on this, and also different organizations within our broad industry. The Gems Keep Giving, which is a new organization. Anyway, there's a lot to talk about, but we're short on time here. I just want to thank you for listening.
For me, having the opportunity to record these conversations and dock them into a podcast serves as somewhat as a time capsule. So looking to conserve this conversation together, I wanted to ask both of you guys, Ian and Brian, I want to say we're looking back at this podcast episode in 10 years from now. We're in 2034. What's one piece of advice, or what's something you want to leave a mark on this year that you want to look back on in the future and say, I'm happy that we achieved this. I'm happy that we reached this point. It could be a piece of advice. It could be something into the future you want to see happen.
Well, do you want Brian to answer that first?
Whatever, whoever wants to take the question, jump right in.
Go ahead, Ian.
No, fair call. Before I answer that question, I want to give you an example of just what's happening in that whole integration process. If anyone looks at the Ethical Gem Suppliers Instagram site, you will see it's already starting to happen. You're already getting people who come to this show and this event, walk out the door, and put up a post that I've just bought this lovely stone from the Ethical Gem Suppliers, or I'm going there. It's already happening in terms of that relationship situation. So we need to build on that. That's my point. We need to build on that where we currently are, so that everyone does that. So that you and your own businesses and your own websites and your own social posting make it very clear that that is where you source your product from, and that you have being there, you've visited there, because the more we do that and the more we integrate our social media activities particularly, but also our website, but also the stories we tell, that it is a relationship thing, the better off we all are. And then the advancement of traceability and ethical sourcing of gemstone becomes a fait accompli. It just happens.
That's the true luxury.
That's the relationship. Exactly. Yeah. It's just happens. So where we are now, I'd like to reflect on this in maybe 5 years' time and look at where we are with that, happening on the margins occasionally to it becoming just the norm, just how it is.
Yeah. How this reaches the majority market. Brian, any last words?
Yeah, great. Ian, thank you. That's perfect. I'll just speak on the broader picture. As the Homo sapiens species, we're confronted with the whole big issue of how we're going to go forward and survive. And I think the kinds of things we're talking about is related to that, essentially. But it's about what we need to make good decisions on how we do business, what we put our energy and money into. And 10 years from now, you know, don't freak out now because we're in this it's a tilt-a-whirl, crazy climate at the moment, but we'll get past this. And 10 years from now, we'll look back and say, wow, we're still here, you know, and please remember to vote. That's it.
That's perfect. That's the perfect way to leave off today. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And this will be available on Instagram and as well as the Responsible Luxury Podcast. So be sure to tune in. If you missed previous talks the last couple of days, you can check those out there. But I just wanted to thank you guys so much, Ian and Brian, both for joining us today and all the work you guys have done.
Thank you so much for listening to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. If you haven't already, please rate and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. If you have any questions you want answered or ideas to share, please reach out to us at Responsible Luxury Pod or connect with me directly. And don't forget to follow at Responsible Luxury Pod for the latest updates. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.